My name is Peter Payne. My wife and I actually live here in Mount Hermon. I'm not on staff with Mount Hermon, but I love this place. A long time ago, I was three summers summer staff, two years in the summers in the kitchen and 1 year at Ponderosa. The year Ponderosa was in operation. You may not know, but this is the 50th year anniversary for Ponderosa. So it's been serving God quite faithfully for a long time. We actually live within earshot of the camp. In July, there will be a group of 15 high school students from China that my wife works with. They're here for 3 weeks, and 1 week is at Ponderosa. So the Chinese leaders stay with us, and the Chinese kids are up there, which is a culture shock. It's one thing for a Chinese kid to come to American culture, and that's different enough. But to going to an American high school summer camp is like American culture on steroids. But lots and lots of fun. So after a couple days of trying to get their feet on, so they realize, oh, okay, well, this is fun. They develop good relationships, and the kids who are in the cabin with them, after initially thinking, you know, can I relate to these Chinese kids whose English is so-so, that they realize, oh, these are fun people. So it's a great experience for them. I've been doing it for about 10 years, having groups of house church high schoolers coming over here to the U.S. You can pray about that, and that things are getting more and more tight in China, more persecution against Christians. Last year, we found out that some of the students, when they got back, were asked, what did you do? There hadn't been that kind of interrogation about it before. From the China standpoint, this is a cultural enrichment, a chance to practice English. If they knew how Christian it was, they might shut it down or not let people allow people to come. So that's an ongoing concern. There's a tremendous amount of pressure on children not to believe. In some places in China, all the kids in school have been asked, do you have a religious position? And if they say they're Christian, then someone will come one-on-one and meet with them, saying, you don't believe this. This is not Chinese. This is not what you believe. We know of one student who was kicked out of school because he refused to deny his faith. So it's just a really difficult situation in China. It's even worse for the Muslims who are in the far west. There's the Uyghur people, which is a Muslim group, and it's estimated that 500,000 Uyghurs have basically been incarcerated for like 2 months under a re-education camp, trying to teach them that Islam is not the right way and that the Chinese way is. And the use of surveillance cameras around China with face recognition is just an awful, they spy on you, can track you down, and the use of those cameras everywhere in China is really pretty scary. But anyway, that's sort of on the side. The title, I Don't Need God, decided to put together a talk on this title when I was in Germany this last spring. I was an all-Germany Christian Easter conference, and I went to a seminar on hard questions, and the leader of the seminar wrote down questions on a large sheet of paper, about 9 different questions, and then he had the students vote on the 3 they would like to have addressed during the seminar. And the one that got the most votes was how to respond to someone who says, I don't need God. All right, so that was the All-German Easter Conference, Studecon 2019. I'd like to have you turn to someone next to you, and the question is, do you know anyone who has told you, I don't need God? Or you're pretty sure that's the person's perspective that you know, that I don't need God. And what do you think lies behind their comment? So if you know of a particular person who has said that, or you think would say that, what do you think lies behind the comment, I don't need God? So turn to someone next to you and talk about someone you may have met who has said, I don't need God. We're discussing in pairs that question. Okay, you probably can go on for a while, but what were some of the thoughts?
You had a friend who would say, I don't believe in God, so why would I
Uh-huh.
Why would I need God?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I don't think he's there. Obviously, I don't need him if he's not there. I can do fine.
I'm going to heaven. It's not like I'm a murderer or anything. I'm good enough.
I'm good enough. I have a friend whose mom is, for almost all her life, was an atheist. And I talked to her some years ago, and her mom was in her 80s. And she said to her mom, you know, Mom, you're getting older. Have you thought about what will happen when you die? And her response was, well, I assume that when I die, that'll just be it. But if there's God or there's some sort of life after, I'm sure I'll be fine. I'm sure I'll be fine. So people, the idea, if God's there and he's loving and merciful, I don't need to believe in him. He'll be fine with me. I'm a good person. Any other thoughts on what lies behind that? I don't need God. Yeah, yeah. I'm not a sinner. I'm a normal, good person, and not perfect, but, you know, nobody's perfect. But here's three broad categories of what might lie behind. One is the skeptic who does not believe. I don't need God because he's not there. Or if he's there, he can't be known. So I don't need God. The antagonist. I don't need God because I don't like God. I don't like certain doctrines that Christians teach, or I don't like Christians. So there's some edge, something they don't like about Christianity. I don't need him because I don't like what I see of people who are Christians or what I know of Christianity. And then there's people who are just content. I don't need God because I'm doing fine as I am. So those are sort of three broad categories. If you're one of these people, take lots of notes. If you put your name and email address in the back, I'll send you the PowerPoint. And if you don't, I'm doing some writing. I'll be sending out some other things. If you only want to get the PowerPoint, then just say only PowerPoint on it. So where's the person coming from who you know? And a good question. Ask, particularly if a person says, I used to be a Christian, but I don't believe anymore. All right. I like to ask that person, well, do you wish, I know you don't believe anymore, but do you wish the Christian faith were true? If the person says, no, not really. All right. That means there's issues, the things they don't like about Christianity. All right. But if they say, yeah, I do wish it were true, and I've met people who say, yeah, I do wish it were true. That tells me that there's still an openness on the part of the person. When a person says that, if it's a person that I might be able to be in touch with, keeping together, see occasionally. So it sounds as though you would be quite happy if I could persuade you that it's true. I mean, logically that follows if you wish it were true. Well, I guess so. I'll say, I don't guarantee that I can persuade you that the Christian faith is true. But I do think I can persuade you that there's a better case to be made for it than you currently think there is. But that's a good question to ask. Here's some responses, thinking off the top of my head, some response a person might give and ask, well, why do you say I don't need God? I'm a good person. Mention that. I have no need for belief in life after death. I'm content. This is all there is. That's fine. I don't need to make up some story about heaven and hell. Or I would say, belief in God is an emotional crutch. And I don't need an emotional crutch. I'm doing fine. Or I have no need of fairy tales. I only believe that for which there is good evidence. Or church isn't my thing. I have better things to do. I don't need God. God has never done anything for me. Now, there may be some bitterness behind that. There may be something in the past where they pray, God, please, 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 and God didn't come through. And hence they gave up on God. I don't want God or anyone else telling me what to do. I believe in something, but I don't want your God. Belief in God has done more harm than good. If you think about marks into those different categories of skeptic, antagonist, and contentment, there is some legitimate criticism that you sometimes hear from people about the church. One is when they say belief is an emotional crutch. I think oftentimes we convey that, not intentionally, but we oftentimes convey that. When people say how to become a Christian, the story is I was lonely or I was a drug addict, or you know, hear these stories of a person who was in the pits and came out. Well, praise God for those. But if the idea you get is that you become a Christian because, well, you're in the pits, well, I'm not in the pits. So I don't need that. I don't need some emotional crutch to be able to get me out. Also, oftentimes the church talks about emotional benefits. You become a Christian, God will give you peace. He does. God will help you in your relationships. Yes, he can. That's good. God will help you succeed. Well, there's sort of a prosperity gospel, which isn't really from Jesus. But if you ask the question, why did the original disciples follow Jesus? It wasn't for emotional benefits. In fact, following Jesus, they knew that it might cost them their life. Their leader, Jesus, had given his life for them, and they were prepared to die for the faith that they had. And you think about what motivated you to become a Christian. I think we'd get a variety of responses. For many people who grow up in a Christian home, it's not because I'm emotionally needy, but rather perhaps in high school, no, this mission that God's on, that's what I want. This world really is a battle between good and evil. And I want to be on the side of the good. I want to be promoting what God's about. One also has to recognize that I am not where God wants me to be. There needs to be repentance as well as the challenge of following God. But when I ask myself why it is that there's most churches, there's more men than women. And I say, why is that? Well, I think part of it is that we present the gospel as an emotional benefits gospel. You become a Christian for emotional benefits. It's true, many people become Christians because of the emotional benefits they see or the loneliness that they have. But at the same time, being a Christian is not just a matter of emotional benefits. It's a matter of being with the one who is going to solve the problems of the history of the world, of people. We are on the side of God, accomplishing what God wanted. There's a book by Rodney Stark, The Rise of Christianity. The obscure, marginal Jesus movement became the dominant religious force in the Western world for a few centuries. In a few centuries. One of the things he mentions there is that the church grew greatly right after there was a major plague where lots of people died. The non-Christians who were wealthy fled, get out of this community where this disease is taking place. Christians stayed. And the fact that Christians were willing to stay and help the sick and the dying was really significant to people. When you ask, why did people flock to the Christian faith? It wasn't emotional benefits. I mean, there could be those. But rather, it's God. It's God who's calling us to a high calling of caring for each other, serving one another, and being served, and seeing that lived out was very, very attractive. The prosperity gospel. Do you want to be happy? Do you want to be successful? Do you want internal peace? Do you want a happy marriage? Do you want a harmonious family? Do you want to be part of a loving community? Do you want to go to heaven? Well, the answer to all of those, of course, all of us want those things. But that's not what Jesus said about to his disciples about what being a follower of him would mean. He says you need to be willing to give your life for me. If you gain, so try to save your life, you'll lose it. If you give your life for me, you'll in your life. And following Jesus came at a high cost. When I think of men, and when I was during the Jesus movement, it was roughly equal, men and women who were part of the Jesus movement. Part of that was was that the idea was we are part of this vanguard of what God is doing. And there was the challenge which is there. And I think men, and this is generalization, men tend to be work-oriented, action-oriented. What can I do? They're not emotionally as sensitive as women are. Of course, that's a generalization. There's some women who aren't very touched with their emotion and men who are very emotional. But I think that we need, and when we're talking about the gospel, that it's a challenge to us, this wonderful task, this opportunity to serve God, which we have. It's not just simply, if I become a Christian, then I'll have these added benefits. Jesus, in speaking to crowds in Luke 14, says, "Now great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple.' So for any of you who does not all he has cannot be my disciple." I'm right now finishing up an essay, sort of understand this. Looking at is this Jesus. I mean, some cults say don't have any touch, contact with your family. That's not what Jesus is actually saying here. But Jesus is calling for a radical commitment. And what does one think of that? So something I should be able to send you in a little bit is sort of this essay that I've written up on Luke 14 and trying to make sense of it. Does this kind of a radical call commitment make sense in what kind of circumstances? Send that on to you. But when a person says, "I don't need God," if this is Jesus' calling, "I don't need you," is not. Plus, you're missing out on entering the kingdom of God of eternal life. Matthew 7, 21, 23, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name?' And then I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness.'" The rich young ruler comes to Jesus and says, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus reminds him of some of the Ten Commandments. Actually, interesting, he doesn't mention coveting. The man says, "All these I've kept from my youth." When Jesus heard this, he said to him, "One thing you still lack. Sell all that you have and distribute to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." The man is wealthy and sad and leaves, and then Jesus turns to his disciples and says, "How difficult it is for those who have wealth to enter the kingdom of God. For it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven." The disciples say, "Well, who can be saved then?" And Jesus says, "With God, all things are possible." So it's not as though being wealthy means you can't make it into heaven. But the tendency is when you're wealthy, or when you're particularly gifted in certain ways, maybe academically or whatever, your tendency is to trust in those things rather than trust in God. And Jesus says, "I want myself to be first and foremost. And I don't want a divided heart where part of your heart is on academic success or work success, or part of my heart is on you. I want totally your heart." And that's what Jesus calls. So I don't need God. Part of what we need to do is to help correct their conception of what being a Christian is about. It's about following him and the opportunity to serve him and the privilege of doing so. Jesus promised life to the full. This is the good, after I say I'm the good shepherd. But it's not a life of comfort and ease. It's a full life, but it's a life which is on Jesus, God's terms. Jesus says, "My peace I leave with you." But right after this says, "It is not as the world gives." Then says, "Let not your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid." Jesus gives peace, but that doesn't mean comfort and ease with everything going smoothly. It's a peace that we can have when things aren't going well. It's in the midst of hard times that Jesus says, "I will be at peace for you." It's not just sort of the God will give me this lack of anxiety and everything will be comfortable and smooth. Okay. Another problem is that people have the idea, many people have the idea, that Christians, not only are they anti-abortion, but they don't care for needy children, the poor, immigrants, social justice, the environment, while supporting policies sheltering the wealth of the wealthy. It puzzles me why it is that people say, oh, I'm Republican, and everything which is sort of fits in the category Republican they vote for, and Democrat, everything that fits in that category. And the different issues are issue by issue. Where do you stand? Am I a Republican or I'm a Democrat? Well, look at the issue. What are issues that actually line up with what God tells us? And I think it is true that oftentimes Christians have not supported the ways in which government and programs that can help the needy, the poor, immigrants, having compassion in that way. Interesting enough, the image that, people from outside have this image, Christians aren't really caring people. I don't want to get into politics. I mentioned on Tuesday that Donald Trump, and when people associate Christians with Donald Trump, there's all kinds of baggage, which leads to negative impressions of what Christians are about. They don't care about a person lying all the time or being immoral. All that matters is the person is doing what I want. So I think we have an uphill battle when it comes to presenting the gospel in a way which is going to be attractive to people today. It is worth noting that when studies are done about who actually gives more to charities, people who have faith in God tend to give more to charities, not simply giving to the church, but giving more to charity. And when it even comes to something like donating blood, conservative people, people who have religious faith, are more apt to donate blood. So even though they may not sort of sound like they care and are compassionate people, when you look at their actual behavior, Christians are really quite compassionate. I mean, lots of people who say Christians aren't compassionate. And I say, have you ever looked at how Christians spend their time? And you may be quite impressed to find that they actually do care about the poor person next door, the people around them. But we need to be more consistent about that. We should care for people generally and not sort of politically be sound like we don't care. Okay, there's another that I'm going to deal with, the category of contentment now. Not being open to change. There was a book that came out some years ago by two staff members of InterVarsity, really quite excellent evangelists. The title of the book was, I Once Was Lost. I'm not quite sure why that was the title of it, but their basic thesis was that when a person becomes a Christian, it's not simply a matter of crossing the threshold to decide to follow Jesus. There are other thresholds they need to cross before they get to that one. And so they list five different thresholds that people need to cross, and starts off with a person not trusting Christians and then gaining trust. When a person has trust, they're willing to listen. If they don't trust, they won't listen to you. But the third one is a threshold of moving from being close to change to open to change. If a person is content with their life, I'm fine, everything's going fine, there's not much motivation to take seriously the Christian faith. And particularly if you're in a setting where most people around you don't believe, I'm in the university context, to be a Christian is costly. People will think less of you because you're a Christian. So why would I want to become a Christian? I'm content with where I'm at. And it's hard. How do you help people? How do you help a person move from being content with where they're at to actually helping them wish that things were different? That's a challenge for us. A few thoughts that I have on that. One is it's important that we as Christians be transparent. Because when a person becomes a Christian, there's both the side of repentance, of seeing they're not where they need to be. They're more selfish than they typically really want to acknowledge. And they also need a vision of what they could be, of what they ought to be. And I think as Christians, if we are transparent about our own struggles, that person will be more transparent themselves about their struggles. They may say, I'm fine, I'm a good person, but if you start talking about struggles that you have, you'll find that they become more open about struggles that they have. And when they're honest about the struggles that they have, some of that barrier to becoming a Christian is being lowered. I know I sometimes have told non-Christians that I don't like it when I find myself being sarcastic. I think one of the liabilities of going to a good university is that smart people like sarcasm. Just sarcasm is fun. It's putting people down. And for myself, it doesn't bring light into my heart. It brings darkness into me. And I say, I don't want that to be true of myself. I want to be a person who doesn't slip into this sarcastic attitude. And for most non-Christians, what? Sarcasm is fun. What do you mean you don't want? So I'm trying to give them a little bit of vision for what I would like to be. And if they say, if I were that way, if I weren't so nasty in my heart, okay, I really would be a better person. And if they can get to know Christians, and if you're transparent, that helps them to get to know you and begin to see that what helps you might actually help them. So by your own relationship with them, you can begin to develop a vision for what life could be. Encourage them to look at Jesus. One of the best things you can do, if a person is open to it, is to get involved in an investigative Bible discussion, typically in the Gospels. And most people, when they look at Jesus in the Gospels, find Jesus attractive. And one of the interesting things about Jesus is never canned. He never gives the same response to, he speaks to every person individually. And how Jesus responds and interacts with people is very attractive. I mean, there's some things that, wait a minute, but generally, typically speaking, when a person looks at Jesus, they're attracted by that. Plus, they begin to see, here's a standard of life, of character that I'm not. Christians actually, in certain ways, resemble what I like about Jesus. So when you're studying the life of Jesus and looking at it, not only is the relationship being built between the non-Christian and the Christian, and they're being attracted to you, they're also being attracted to Jesus, and those two things come together. So that's actually one of the best ways of being able to develop motivation in a person who isn't motivated simply by getting them to look at Jesus. Second one, animosity. Points of dislike. It may be that the person's had negative experiences with Christians. I've had conversations with people who said in high school and grew up in church, but when they would ask questions, they were always told, don't ask questions. You just have to believe. So I felt like there was a straitjacket. You just simply can't ask any of these questions. They got the university and they can ask questions. Breath of fresh air. Throw aside this Christian faith and now things are free and wonderful. Actually, in that kind of context, I'll typically say to the person, actually, my experience was quite different than yours. Like I said Tuesday, sort of this dangling question. And the person, how so? And for me, it was a matter of growing up in a home where I could ask those questions. I don't know if on Tuesday I mentioned the family discussions where my oldest brother was at. Did I mention that for those of you who heard Tuesday? Okay, so one needs to be able to say, look, God, asking questions is fine and good. We need to be able to encourage people to ask questions and then be able to help them with those questions. Dislike sometimes the exclusivity of the gospel. So the Christians claim the Bible is true and all other religious books are false wherever they contradict the Bible. I don't like that. Actually, people ought to hope, if they really want to know something about God, they ought to hope that God has revealed himself to us. One of the points that I make is that all we had was just our ordinary experience and, say, philosophical reasoning. One wouldn't come to the conclusion that God cares about us. There might be some good out there, but it's a mixture of good and bad. The idea that God actually cares about us and wants to interact with us is something you only get if God has actually revealed himself to us. So if a person wishes they could know what God is like, they shouldn't cast aside the idea that God's actually revealed himself. They should say, let's hope that God's revealed himself clearly somewhere. But if he has, then that means things which are logically incompatible with it can't also be true. It's not arrogance. It's simply that if God has revealed himself clearly in some place, then the things that don't agree with that can't be true. So it's not just a matter of arrogance. Of course, there's the problem of exclusivity of the gospel that they talk about eternal judgment. And people will object to how can you possibly believe the Christian faith is true and believe that God would send people to hell? Or how is it that you have to believe in Jesus to have eternal life? Or they view faith as being pitted against reason. My wife's twin brother is homosexual. And he had been said he was a Christian when he was in high school and university. He turned his back on it because he decided he was homosexual, and that was an okay direction for him to go. So sexuality can be a point of dislike. Sometimes people look at the God of the Old Testament and say, look at all this violence in the Old Testament. I don't like the God of the Bible. So that's another issue. I'm also working on an essay entitled, What About the Canaanites? What is God like that he would command that the Israelites would wipe out the Canaanites who were there? Actually, the language of drive out is more common than wipe out. And there's large numbers of Canaanites who actually left. So it's not the fact that you had this mass genocide with nearly everyone being killed. 2 years ago, there was a tomb, a Canaanite tomb, in now it is Lebanon. And they did a DNA test on it. And the DNA analysis told them that current day Lebanese are largely Canaanite. So not only were there some Canaanites who fled, there were lots of Canaanites who fled. Enough who fled, so they became the dominant genetic stream in what is now Lebanon instead of the people who were there before. But anyway, that's a complicated topic. Okay, how about bridges to faith for the skeptic? One is the reality of conscious mental states and persons. If you ask the scientist, what is a person? Well, as a scientist, he can talk about neurons and brain, and he can talk about behavior. But where is this person, this subject? There's no place in the brain that's the master control center of the brain that controls everything else. Who am I as a person? Or even when one talks about what are emotions, what are feelings, what is the feeling of pain? From the standpoint of science, there is no feeling of pain, there's just pain behavior. There's neurons firing, interacting with each other, but at no point is there a feeling of pain. That's a serious problem for a person who thinks that we're nothing but physics. If we're nothing but physics, then it seems as though our feelings, the sense of sensation of pain, must be nothing but simply physics. So there is no really any feeling of pain, it just is pain behavior. Here's a gloomy view of human race from Francis Crick, rather the one who got the Nobel Prize for the structure of DNA. It says, you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Who you are is nothing but a pack of neurons. Well, a person who says, I don't need God, okay, I'm fine with that. Well, so no, I'm not really fine with that. Doesn't seem to me I'm just a pack of neurons. It's the subjective me that matters to me. It's my experience, my thoughts, my conscious thoughts. I mean, that's what really matters to me, and say I'm nothing but a pack of neurons. That can give me some motivation for wishing that naturalism is not true. And if naturalism is not true, then maybe I do need God. So that's one avenue. There's a philosopher who's an atheist, staunch atheist, philosopher of mine at New York University, who wrote a book in 2012 called Mind and Cosmos, but the subtitle was the grabber. The subtitle was Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. And almost all atheists I know are convinced that the naturalism is almost certainly true. In fact, their reason for rejecting belief in God is, well, there's nothing but physics. If there's nothing but physics, then anything spiritual is simply a subjective experience. There's no reality to it. There is nothing supernatural. There's nothing but the physical world and physics. But in fact, if Thomas Nagel is right, and his argument actually is quite a strong argument, an argument which non-Christians can understand as well as Christians, then naturalism is false, which opens the door to what is the nature of mind, and how does it fit into it. The question of free will. I was invited by a grad student who is sort of an advisor to an atheist club at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where my wife and I oversee a grad student fellowship. And there are about 7 undergraduate students and the grad student, and I asked them whether they believed they had free will. Interesting enough to me, the grad student said, no, we don't. And one of the 7 undergrads said, no, we don't. The rest said, yes, we do. But if, in fact, we're biochemical machines, the idea that we actually control, that have any freedom of the will, just simply does not make sense within a naturalist worldview. And for most people, they really do want to believe there's some free will. Now, by free will, I don't mean that you can do anything that you want to do, or that every time you do something, you could have done otherwise. But the question of free will is, do I have any control or influence on the course of my life? Are all my decisions actually dictated by prior states of my brain? Is everything that I do dictated by the past? If it is, then it's an illusion that I'm actually directing my life. And for people to think it's actually an illusion that I'm directing my life is an uncomfortable thought. It's an uncomfortable thought even for atheists. And there are a fair number of atheists who do believe in free will. There's a prominent atheist philosopher at UC Berkeley who had a course on nature of mind. And I this was back when they had cassettes of each of the lectures. And one of the lectures was on free will. And interestingly, he said, I believe we have free will. Well, how can you believe we have free will? He says, I can't explain it in terms of my metaphysical system, but it seems to me experientially that I do have free will, that we do have free will. So if you believe free will matters, then your motivation, I don't need God, well, you ought to hope that you actually have some free will. If you don't, then responsibility is illusion. A person can only be responsible if, in fact, they are the ones who carry it out. If ultimately it was things outside their control, then everyone is simply a victim or a product of their past, and moral responsibility is an illusion. Moral right and wrong. Is there a more objective right and wrong? From an atheist standpoint, it's quite easy to say there is no moral right and wrong. It's all a matter of human biology, say human emotions, things human beings are inclined to do, and a matter of socialization. Society trains people to be better citizens so the society will work better. But there's no objective right and wrong. It's just a matter of what people or individuals or societies like. Part of the problem with that is that almost all of us do believe there is right and wrong. And not only do we tend to believe there is right and wrong, but our own happiness, it turns out, depends on believing that there's right and wrong and believing that we've acted in accordance with it. There have been studies done on what promotes happiness, what contributes to human happiness. And one of the most important things is a person believes that how they have lived their lives in the main have contributed to the good, that they have lived their life in the right way, that they have that they look back on their life and say, I've done what is right. When a person can look at their life and say, I've done what is right and I've contributed to the good, their life can have a lot of hardship and yet they have a deep satisfaction with their life. And much more important to happiness than simply pleasurable experiences is satisfaction with one's life. You can have lots of pleasurable experiences and not be satisfied with your life, or you're not happy. So the deeper sense of happiness is not just pleasant experiences, it's contentment and satisfaction with your life. But to be satisfied with your life, you really need to believe your life has a greater meaning than just simply the meaning that you put into it. So if an atheist says there really is no greater good, they're actually undercutting their own happiness. In fact, I can imagine a person who's an evolutionist saying that somehow human evolution has caused us to be inclined to believe in objective right and wrong. And hence, even though it doesn't make sense, given what the atheist affirms, nonetheless, we very much want to believe that, and part of our flourishing as human beings depends on believing it. Okay, I don't need God. Well, do you need for there to be a genuine right and wrong? Versus, I don't need happiness. Most people don't say that. They want happiness, they want contentment, they want satisfaction with their life. If you want that, then you need to hold on to morality. If you hold on to objective moral right and wrong, then there needs to be some foundation behind it, and the best way of explaining that is actually saying that God lies behind it. And God knows what is good for our human flourishing, and God is the one who communicates that to us. So I talked about that. There was in 2012, my wife was surfing the internet and came across in CNN an article entitled "Prominent Atheist Blogger Becomes Catholic." So this was her on her very last blog on this atheist blog site, obviously declaring that she'd become a Christian. That was her last blog on the atheist blog site. So CNN was interviewing, a person was interviewing her. And then in the interview, she says, I believed that the moral law wasn't just a Platonic truth, not just there's right and wrong somehow written in the cosmos. I actually believed it was some kind of person. The right and wrong aren't just simply abstract rules printed there somewhere, but actually reflects a person relationship. And the doing what is right is doing what is right in relationship to that person. And therefore, she looked around, and looking around, she decided the Christian faith, in her case, becoming Catholic, but the Christian faith was the most promising place to look for where that source, the grounding for morality would be. So for a fair number of people, this can actually be a significant grounds for moving on the Christian faith. Many people reject the Christian faith, skeptics, because they think science and the biblical faith are incompatible with each other. One of the points that I make is that they make a distinction between what I call order of nature miracles and specific point miracles. It's terms I've made up, so you haven't seen that elsewhere probably. Order of nature miracles are miracles that God needs to do to sustain the order of nature in its general normal functioning. Specific point miracles are miracles that God does at specific points in history for specific reasons, but are not needed to sustain the order of nature. I remember one time hearing a preacher saying that science has been unable to account for how cells differentiate, say how a stem cell becomes two nerve cells, or how a nerve cell becomes two different kinds of nerve cells than the original nerve cell. When a human being is growing, or any animal is growing, cells have to differentiate, become the right kind of cells, the right place, the right time. And how do they know how to do that? And his assumption was, here's a gap in science that science cannot explain, that God must miraculously do it. Well, we do know that the cells become what they become because genes get turned on or turned off. Now, if God is miraculously doing this, that means every time cells differentiate and become something different than what the parent cell was, God is miraculously flipping on and off the genes. Right? Now, God could do that, but it doesn't seem to me likely that God does that. It seems to me that God has created an order of nature within which that takes place by the order of nature God's created. That there are natural explanations in the nature which God has set up where God doesn't have to do miracles to sustain it and keep it going. When one looks in the Bible and asks what order of nature miracles does one find, the only one that might possibly fit for that is creation itself. Kind of hard to fit. Is a specific point miracle? Well, specific points at the beginning of time. But all the other miracles in the Bible are specific point miracles, and none of them are order of nature miracles. There's nowhere in the Bible that says God does miracles to make it rain. Now, God can withhold rain, and he can bring rain, but it doesn't say that any of your normal weather cycle is miraculously brought about by God. God has created a world which is naturally ordered. So the success of science fits with believing there are no order of nature miracles, or very few of them. There may be order of nature miracles when it comes to human consciousness. Where does the soul fit in? Where does the person develop? But when it comes to looking at what science has accomplished, the success of science says there are none or very few order of nature miracles. And that fits with what the Bible says. It doesn't give us examples of order of nature miracles, but it doesn't tell us whether God does specific miracles at specific points. So for instance, if you ask, what about the virgin birth? Well, the virgin birth of Jesus is not a big miracle. I had some discussion last time I was talking about this. Was Mary contributing half the DNA and then God creating the other half? I've always sort of assumed that's the case, but if say Mary contributes half the DNA, for God to create the other half of the DNA is a massive number of miraculous getting things lined up to actually have Jesus be a virgin birth. Well, does science tell us that that cannot take place? No, science can tell us how things normally take place, and science may be able to tell us that normally as a child's developing, there aren't miracles that need to be done in the different phases of development. But science can't answer the question whether God did a virgin birth. The scientists have to say, well, if it happened, it would have to be a miracle. Well, yes, that's exactly what we're saying. But the success of science doesn't tell us that God does not do miracles at specific points, at specific times. So science is completely compatible. In fact, there's good reason to believe that God would create an exquisitely ordered universe. In fact, when one looks at the order of universe from a skeptical standpoint, the natural world seems extraordinarily fine-tuned for the possibility of life. Stephen Hawking, both in his Brief History of Time and then later in his later book, was the grand design. In both of those, he says there's extraordinary fine-tuning of the laws of physics, of the basic physical constants. And without this extraordinary fine-tuning, life would not be possible. Well, he doesn't say, therefore, God exists. He says we must live in a universe where there's an infinite number of universes, where all possible, physically possible universes are actualized. And no matter how remotely small the probability is that it can support life, we have to be in one of those universes. So that's his response. But from a Christian standpoint, we say, no, we don't have to invoke an infinite number of universes or M theory with all the different, this vast number of universes being created. We can believe that God has created this universe and he's the one who has fine-tuned it. Now, it's not a matter of my being able to prove that my position is right and Stephen Hawking's position is wrong. But at the same time, Stephen Hawking recognizes that this wonderful fine-tuning is something which is quite extraordinary and needs some explanation. And hence, the multiverse is what he opts for. And I think most people who are in physics and astronomy are leaning towards a multiverse explanation rather than saying there is no apparent fine-tuning.
Peter, is there any evidence of a multiverse?
There are cosmological theories which, if they are correct, would lend themselves to a multiverse. In addition to the Big Bang, there is an infinite number of Big Bangs, right? So our Big Bang is not the only one, but there's a vast, vast number of Big Bangs. So that's one way of getting a multiverse out of it. So it's not as though one can give no justification for a multiverse, but a significant part of the reason for a multiverse is this fine-tuning.
It's just to explain away.
Yeah, and again, there are some cosmological speculations where a natural part of it would be that there be a multiverse. So it's not as though it's just made up to get around the fine-tuning problem. But for the Christians, there's no problem. I mean, the Bible doesn't tell us that ours is the only universe. So the Bible does not actually close the idea of a multiverse, but we don't have to buy into this multiverse to be able to account for the world in which we live. In fact, many people say science goes with what you can demonstrate. Well, this multiverse is not something you demonstrate. It's pure speculation. And the best you could ever possibly have for it is that pure speculation actually is able to account for a lot of things, and as sort of a carry-on with it, you'd have an explanation of the universe around us. Then there's evidence for specific miracles. We all know stories of people who seemingly miraculously healed. I had a friend who was in South Africa, and this car came roaring over the top of a hill and ran into him, and he got flipped over the car, and a person who came over was a doctor, and said he was dead. But lo and behold, he started breathing. Went to the hospital, and they said, it'll take you years. It was just broken up, something terrible. It'll take you years to be able to recover. Within weeks, he was doing what doctors said would take years. Right? Now, I can't prove that there's actual miracle taking place there, but there are lots of things like that which happen, which certainly sound like, you know, God is doing something extraordinary. Plus, when one asks, what's the evidence for specific points of specific miracles, sometimes the skeptic will say, there's no actual report of a miracle which has sufficient evidence for us to believe it. So, yeah, miracles theoretically could take place, but we look at all the reports, none of them have sufficient evidence. And I say, well, why do you say they don't have sufficient evidence? A number of them have quite a bit of evidence behind them. Why do you say the bar is above that? Well, probably the reason why they say the bar is above that is because they believe that miracles can't happen. That's why the bar is placed so high. But my argument from specific point miracles and order of nature miracles, science doesn't tell us that. It doesn't answer that question. So one shouldn't just set the bar above that. In fact, if a person sets the bar so high that no actual report meets that standard, one isn't then appealing to actual reports to say they can't happen. One is engaged in circular reasoning. One is assuming miracles can't happen, therefore I'm going to dismiss all evidence for all cases, no matter how good it may be. The most important miracle for us as Christians is the resurrection. in terms of our theology and what God has done for us. And there's actually a very good case for the resurrection of Jesus when one looks at the facts that all the scholars will agree upon. And how does one account for those facts? The best explanation is that Jesus actually rose, and there is no good naturalistic explanation. So in terms of explanatory power, the case for the resurrection of Jesus is quite good. Of course, if a person thinks that miracles can't happen, that dead men stay dead, they would say, well, that can't be the right answer. We simply don't have the right answer yet. In fact, when I give a lecture on the evidence for the resurrection, I'd like, if I can, to do two lectures. The first is the case for the resurrection, the historical case. And then I'll do a second lecture, which I entitled, But Dead Men Don't Rise, the objection which is given. Part of the value of that is that because they know I'm going to address that in the second lecture, they're not sort of having the static, but it can't happen, but they don't rise. So they actually listen more to the first lecture, and when it comes to the second lecture, it's looking at the philosophical arguments and scientific arguments that are given for saying that dead men don't rise. So we have the experience. Then finally, there's experience that people have. So a person says, I don't need God. We can pray that person will have experiences actually create within them a need, a belief for God, a need for God. Something will happen. Now, sometimes it may be a calamity. I don't need God, and then things go south. Things are going very well academically, and suddenly they fail. Or they, you know, things are no longer going smoothly as they were before. We can pray that, in fact, that will help create some motivation to help them see they're not self-sufficient. But also, people can have experiences which cause them to say, God, actually, to believe in God. I knew a professor at the University of Michigan who was not a Christian yet, but he had a dramatic experience within convincing that God exists. There was a grad student at the University of California, Santa Cruz here, who was not a Christian yet, but he believed that God existed because he was had lightning strike right next to him. Didn't actually hit him, but his conclusion from that, I'm not sure why he thought this, but his conclusion was, I think God is trying to get my attention. So God can get your attention through experiences, and those experiences are things which you may need. I don't know if I mentioned on Tuesday, there's a friend who I met who grew up Catholic, but had walked away from the faith. And we had this ongoing friendship and dialogue about the Christian faith. At one point, I thought, you know, want to know, is he open to becoming a Christian? And so I said, how are you in that? He said, I don't think I'm very close. Did I mention this Tuesday? Okay, so yeah, he said, I don't think I'm very, very close. So I gave him, I said, there's some thoughts I'd like to pass on to you. I had sort of talked to him about sort of that one can actually believe in the face of doubts. So if you have doubts, there's nothing you can do with that. You can't pretend they go away. If you have doubts, well, that's just the way it is. And I said, no, you can have doubts, and yet you can genuinely believe. You have to have reason to believe, but you can still have doubts and say, I believe, help my unbelief, like the man who came to Jesus with a demon-possessed son. And Jesus asks, the question is, do you believe that I can heal your son? And the man says, I believe, help my unbelief. I think there are a lot of non-Christians who are in that place. I believe enough, yes, I can go with this. I still have doubts and questions. That's okay to have doubts and questions. This person who I mentioned didn't become a Christian at that point, but towards the end of the year, the commencement was coming on, and he was going on to become a band director at a high school back in Maryland. And I knew this sort of border towards the blind becoming a Christian. So the last chance I had to get together with him before graduation, I was going to say, look, if there's no strong reason you have for not believing, just do it. You know enough to do it. Act on that. But before I got to that, he said that either that Sunday or the Sunday before, he'd gone to the local Catholic church, and the priest was reading from the Gospels. And he says, as he was reading from the Gospels, it seemed to me that God was speaking to me. And it wasn't some dramatic psychological experience. It wasn't as though, this cannot be explained in naturalistic terms. But what he needed was to be able to move from, well, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, sort of this intellectual mind game, is it true, is it not? He needed some subjective personal experience that God was actually reaching out to him, and God gave that to him. If a person asks, well, will God reveal himself, demonstrate himself to me? I'm asked, what are you expecting? What are you asking for? If you're asking for God to do a miracle, something which could not be explained in any kind of natural way, God could do that, but I don't think you should expect that God will do that for you. He's done it for other people, and there's good reason to trust them. If you think God has to do this for me, then maybe you're not all that close to becoming a Christian after all, if that's that we require. But if you're asking, will God show himself to me in some way which personally, subjectively to me, can make sense to me and assure me that God is actually reaching out to me, I think God does answer that kind of prayer. So pray, God, show yourself to me in some way. Not necessarily something really dramatic, but reveal yourself to me. I think God does answer that kind of prayer. Okay, we have a few minutes. Questions?
It seems to me, and I really like some of your moral arguments that lead to the conclusion that it's hopeless without God. You know, that chaos exists if there isn't some order, and that you take it from a standpoint, okay, there's no God. And wouldn't you say that might be more of a deductive reasoning? Inductive reasoning as opposed to deductive reasoning. And somehow to come to, you know, this place where science is always trying to, they put up a hypothesis and then they try their best to say, well, this hypothesis is wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong. But inductively they can't. So they wind up saying, well, we can't prove for absolutely sure. We certainly can seem to say we can't reach that conclusion. Inductively. And so I'm just, it just seems, and once again, I feel like Ned in first grade, so please don't feel that, you know, that you're way off. But it seems to me that when you're dealing with science, you have to always deal just with the reasoning through induction, as opposed, and then when we get off into philosophy, and having to argue with the Muslims, say, or some, you know, you're dealing with deduction. Is there any, does that make sense to you?
Okay, so for the recording, the question was about the argument from ethics, from morality, seems like a deductive kind of argument, where arguments in science are inductive kinds of arguments. Actually, science is not all that inductive. It develops expectations, which sort of inductive expectations. All the crows that you've seen are black. You kind of expect a crow to be black. But if a white crow comes along, right, you don't say, well, I'm inductive, therefore it cannot be a white crow. Well, actually, sometimes surprises. The genetics are different, so this is a crow which is actually white. You know, so science is actually open to the facts, the observations. Now one can question, well, was this really a fact? Was the data correct? We need to repeat the data. But when something is shown to be actually true and observably true, you don't have to give an inductive argument for saying it's observably true. Rather, you have to say, okay, we observe to be true, now what do we do that? And then you get sort of the explanatory power, how do you fit it into a scheme, or how do you adjust your theories so it can actually make sense of it. So science, despite sort of the inductive, is not as simple, not simple induction like we think of it. And when it comes to the ethics argument, I think an atheist can quite reasonably say, okay, I think just our emotions, our ethics are part of human nature. We're a social animal. And we're social animals that develop certain norms. Dogs have certain norms about how they relate to each other. People have certain norms that relate to each other. And that's how we behave. Part of the problem with that is that some dogs don't behave like dogs are supposed to behave. And some human beings don't behave like most human beings behave. And does that make them wrong? Okay, no, there's unusual dogs. So they're not immoral people, they're just unusual people. People who don't go by the normal sort of ways in which most people relate to each other. Most people don't go around killing each other. If God didn't exist, it would still be the case that most people won't go around killing each other. But nonetheless, if there are people who do, you know, what makes that wrong? And the satisfaction that we have in doing what is right is not simply the satisfaction that I'm operating the way which 90% of human beings operate, right? Or say you care for your children. Suppose 1% of parents don't care for their children. Does 99% make the 99% right and the 1% wrong? So there's not much satisfaction. Well, I'm doing what the majority of human beings would do. Where's the great satisfaction of that? Or where's the great satisfaction saying I'm doing what my society has told me I should do? All right, so why should I care about what society has told me? The satisfaction comes in believing somehow that your life is actually meaningful, that you ought to. So there's this moral sort of sense, which doesn't come out as in any sort of scientific way. And a person philosophically can say there is no objective right and wrong. And it's not as though there's no meaning whatsoever. Atheist parents can care for their children. As human beings, they'll typically care for their children. But when it comes to their making sacrifices for doing what's right, why should I make the sacrifice? If I'm not going to feel much, much better because I made the sacrifice, then I won't make the sacrifice. So if there is no God, things will move towards an ethics of convenience, an ethics of what benefits me, and how bad will I feel if I go this way or that way. But nonetheless, as human beings, our own sense of personal worth is very much very tightly tied to our acting in ways which we believe are right. And it's that which crumbles if atheism is true. It's not a deductive argument that says God must exist, but it's more of a motivational argument saying, I very much want to believe this, and I am inclined to believe this, and I recognize from studies that if I don't believe it, I'll be less satisfied with my life, less happy. Now, an atheist may say, well, okay, so we're less happy. But if you're less happy, you ought to say, does the argument actually demonstrate this is what I must believe? Is it irrational for me to believe that there really is objective right and wrong? Well, from a Christian perspective, no, it's not irrational. There really are ways in which God has made us. Not everyone, there are certain exceptions, but nonetheless, God says that you will be accountable to me. So there's a personal accountability for these standards as well as God knowing what human flourishing involves. So it's neither are strictly deductive or inductive. I've had discussions with other Christians, the other Christian philosophers, who are very deductive. Their arguments are, if these premises are true, then this conclusion must be true. But for myself, I think the important conclusions are almost never deductive. There's always, well, this evidence supports the conclusion, but doesn't prove the conclusion. But unfortunately, there's no logic and inductive logic that tells you how much weight to give to these different arguments, to these different parts of the evidence. So there's a subjectivity which comes into almost anything which is an important proposition that we have. So it's not as though reason, logic dictates it. There is no logic which dictates it. There are things which I think are general patterns of reasoning which other people have, and we can communicate along those lines and make some progress. But it's not that the Christian conclusion is deductively demonstrable, whereas the atheist conclusion is deductively false. And so I tend to be more on the looser side of you have evidence to support conclusions and the Christian faith is well supported. It's reasonable in that broad sense, without my claiming that if you're an atheist, you're being less rational than I am. Because part of my sense of rationality is what makes sense to me, but that's also going to be true for him or for her, where that person's coming from. Okay, let me stop at this point. We had lunch, but let me mention again, there's a clipboard in the back. If you like the PowerPoint, go ahead and sign up on that. If you don't want to get any other emails after this, my wife and I spend time in Europe, and when we're in Europe, we give regular reports of what's taking place. I'll be back there this end of December for an all-Europe student conference, so I'd be giving reports on that. So if you don't want anything but the PowerPoint, mention that, but if you put your name and email address, I'll send the PowerPoint for today. And if you weren't here Tuesday, I'll go ahead and send Tuesday's PowerPoint to you as well if you're interested. So thanks very much.